This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear from violinist and conductor Scott Yu about the making of the PBS series, Now Hear This.
So when the violinists had their masks off, the cellists all had their masks on. And then when they said cut, then the director would always yell, everybody masks on.
Also, we'll learn how to make beer from local wild yeast.
What kind of yeast does Poison Oak give you?
We've never sampled the Poison Oak areas. This will be the most Poison Oak areas we've ever sampled.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, October 5th, 2020. I'm Carol Tangeman. Central Coast voters started getting their November 2020 general election ballots in the mail last week. And this election is going to be like no other in recent history. Between the pandemic, new machinery, possible power shutoffs, and operational changes, county election officials face a daunting job this year. KCBX's Greta Mart spoke with San Luis Obispo County's top election official, Tommy Gong, about what voters need to know.
I'm hoping that you can clear up some confusion around, will there be polling places this election?
Yeah, we're calling them voter service centers. It's for in-person voting, and those will be for 4 days of voting, starting on October 31st through Election Day. So it starts on the Saturday before, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. The first 3 days will be from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and then, of course, on Election Day, it'll be from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. At these locations, it's not only set up for in-person voting, but also voters who just want to drop off their voted vote by mail ballot. So it'll serve, you know, multiple purposes that way. But certainly we'll have the ability for voters to vote in person, keeping in mind all of the health and safety measures that are taking into effect. Yeah, it's quite a different animal on these larger locations to allow voters to vote safely. 23 of those locations located throughout the county.
23 of them, okay. Is this the first election that this is this way?
Yeah, so it falls back again on the concerns about the coronavirus during the spring. And that's when the Secretary of State started facilitating like weekly or biweekly or triweekly calls with county election officials as well as advocacy groups over how we're going to conduct this election. And so the two basic premises was that every voter will automatically receive a ballot in the mail, but yet we will have a limited number of voter service centers available to voters for in-person voting. It very closely follows SB 450, which was voted into law by the legislature, I want to say, in 2016. And that gave counties the option of sending every voter a ballot in the mail, as well as having vote centers. And that ratio is one vote center per 10,000 registered voters versus the typical a polling place ratio, which is one per 1,000 voters.
Got it. But San Luis Obispo County was not one of the counties that chose to do that at that time. Am I correct?
Right. Yeah, I didn't want to make the change this year, given that it's a presidential cycle. But because of coronavirus and the talking it through early in the game helped us be able to prepare, find these larger locations, and that the funding came through both from federal grants and state grants to be able to purchase the equipment that would be required at these locations and all of the preparation that has to go into, you know, getting this equipment all set up.
So these are new voting machines that say I go into one, I would be on a new voting machine?
Actually, that's a good question. There's a couple of different options for voters. So when they check in, instead of having a traditional paper roster, we'll be checking them in with laptops that are connected to our voter registration system here in the county building. This allows, we're going to have like up-to-date information as to a voter status. So One of the premises of the voter service center is that a voter can go to any voter service center, not to like an assigned polling place. So that gives them more flexibility to be able to, you know, if on Saturday they happen to be in town, let's say, that they could vote on Saturday or Sunday. But what it does is it allows us to be able to check on a voter status. For instance, we have to be sure that their vote by mail ballot has not already been returned and counted. In that case, the voter would have to vote provisionally. That's something we typically do at a polling place. But given that their vote by mail was not returned, then they can be vote in person. And then they'll have a couple of different options. We're gonna have ballot on demand printers, which means that we'll have blank ballot stock that we'll keep inventory over. And then depending on the voter's precinct that they're entitled to vote on, then we'll be able to get them that specific ballot, which is something we weren't able to do with pre-printed ballots at a traditional polling place. So again, giving more voters that flexibility during the 4 days of voting. And we'll also have the accessible voting devices. Now, these we deployed in March. They were used more so than they've ever been before. And now we're required to have three of these units at each voter service center. And so that kind of falls into our ratio of the number I ordered for March. I ordered about 100 of them. And that falls into place for me to having multiple units as required by law in this type of operation.
I see. Okay. Wow. That's a lot.
Yeah. It's a whole new dimension added to the election. The whole the health and safety procedures in it is just an additional add-on. We're really getting kind of a triple whammy because, you know, the operation is a little different. The locations are much larger. You know, we're deploying new equipment. We have health and safety to worry about. And not only that, but we have power shutdowns, potential power shutdowns that might occur, you know, by PG&E if there are any concerns for public safety by PG&E.
What's going to happen in that case if that happens?
Yeah, good question. So we procured five generators to be on hand to power up a location. In fact, last week we did a power lab connection where we ran the generator to be sure that it would support all of the equipment that we had. In fact, I walked into our warehouse when my staff was doing it, and they had a big bright light there too. And I was like, wow, you know, light was already, you know, it was during the daytime, but they were testing out also the additional lighting that we would provide in the event that there's a power outage. So that's five that we'll have on hand. We're also, a certain number of our locations have a generator of their own. And then I'm also partnering with our County Office of Emergency Services with the units that they have, you know, in case that there's a more widespread power shutdown. So all contingency planning based on, you know, depending on what would happen in that case.
Are you worried about that? Do you foresee any major problems? I mean, what are you worried about?
You're asking me what keeps me up at night, right?
Right.
All of it does. I mean, it's all so new to us, but I will say we are putting a lot of thought and preparation in this. We've been thinking about this since May about how this will occur. And I was able to hire a few consultants. I have my predecessor, Julie Rodewald, on hand. She's going through operationally how the voter service center should operate, as well as the training that's going to go through there. The training is going to be more unique. When we open our offices, both in San Luis Obispo and Atascadero, to voters on October 5th, that would be 29 days before the election, that each day we're going to have training sessions. And both of these locations are going to be set up like a voter service center, with the equipment, with the laptops, and with the ballot on demand printers. So our election workers will come in and they will actually serve voters by utilizing the equipment. And I think I'll have all of the workers who will be staffing those voter service centers being able to have the hands-on with the equipment and getting used to it. They'll be scheduled to do two trainings during the month of October, not to mention the 4 days that we'll be, you know, serving the voters into the election day. So it's really, we're trying to give as much hands-on experience to our workers instead of what we would have done before, which was, you know, we'd have these large, massive trainings, which we couldn't do now because of the coronavirus. So we kind of adapted to that, to making these changes. The other thing is that, you know, with every voter receiving a ballot in the mail, we have to start preparing for that as well, because, you know, historically, with the counties that did adopt SB 450, there were about 14 of them so far. They've had up to 95% of their voters voting by mail. So using that metric, then instead of 100,000 ballots being received like we've typically had, now we're up to 150,000 ballots. So 50% more ballots that we'll have to process. And it's a little more labor intensive. You know, you have to compare the signatures on the envelope to the signature we have on file. You have to open the envelopes. You have to prepare the ballots before you can count them. And so there's more work involved. We have to space out, physically space out, so we can't have as many workers in our tight quarters to be able to have the same capacity that we've had. So we're looking at swing shifts. We're looking at shifting into other rooms in the county government office to be able to keep up with the volume.
That was San Luis Obispo County Clerk, Recorder, and Election Official Tommy Gong speaking with KCBX's Greta Mart. Working Lunch is a San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce Facebook Live conversation. Scott Yu of Festival Mosaic and the PBS series Now Hear This talked with the Chamber's Jim D'Antona.
Today, you'll be joining me in my conversation with Scott Yu, the music director for Festival Mosaic, chief conductor and artistic director of the Mexico City Philharmonic, and host executive producer of the PBS series Now Hear This. And through his Now Hear This series, Scott brings viewers into the life of venerated composers in the same way that immersive food series like Chef's Table have done for global cuisine. In Now Hear This episode, Scott will be sharing San Luis Obispo and Festival Mosaic with the world as he explores becoming Mozart. So maybe if you could just start off by telling us a little bit about your upbringing and the role maybe music played in your childhood.
Sure. I was born in Japan, but I'm not a Japanese citizen. I was naturalized when I was 7 years old. I grew up in Glastonbury, Connecticut. Somewhere in junior, senior year in high school, I started my professional music career as a violinist and then later as a conductor. I think kids get really hooked on baseball, at least pitchers, when they can start curving the ball. I think when you just throw it, it's just like throwing a ball. But when you can spin it and curve it, then the kids get hooked. Of course, it damages their arm. For young musicians, you get hooked when you get to play with the pros play. So when you're playing Go Tell Aunt Rhody or Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, you're not going to get hooked on playing the violin. But for me, when I started getting to play Mozart, particularly one of his violin concertos, and the pros were playing that same music, I thought, oh, wow, this is really fun. So for me, when I was 9 years old, I was playing a Mozart violin concerto. That was the moment where I thought, oh, wow, I want to do this for the rest of my life.
I was a pitcher, and you are exactly right. When you can curve the ball and you destroy your elbow, which I did, you become hooked to that. Has exploration, travel, and discovery always been part of that process?
I first took a plane trip when I was, I think, 6 or 7 years old, and then right after that, I remember thinking, I want to travel all the time. We lived in Hartford between Boston and New York. And so it was an hour and 40-minute drive to Boston, and then it was like a 2-hour and 10-minute drive to New York. And I always liked to be either in Boston or in New York. That to me was the ultimate. And I thought, wow, going to the airport is so much fun. Now, as a nearly 50-year-old man, I can tell you I have not missed going to the airport at all. I can't stand it. But all joking aside, you know, travel and especially meeting new people and people you wouldn't have gotten to meet were it not for travel, for me, that's what you live for.
What does your typical year kind of look like?
I spend 14 to 16 weeks with the orchestra in Mexico City, and I usually do that in 2-week chunks. So 2 weeks, 2 weeks, 2 weeks. If you do 8 chunks, that becomes 16 weeks. Festival Mosaic, I spend all of July in San Luis Obispo, either preparing for the festival or doing the festival. And then I usually come a few more times to do other concerts. We have a series called Winter Mezzo. And so I'll come back to San Luis Obispo. And that's great. It's a lot of work, but it feels like vacation because you're in San Luis Obispo. I mean, it's the best place to be. And then I do some freelance guest conducting, which will take more time. And then there's another festival I go to. And then, of course, Now Hear This. Now Hear This is usually about 2 weeks of shooting and then a week of post-production per episode. So when you subtract all that out, and usually nothing happens the second, third, and fourth weeks of August and in December, just nothing happens. If you subtract those out, that's almost every week of the year in 2020. Of course, now with the pandemic, I've been home.
You are on the road a lot. How has the pandemic changed all of that?
It has changed it a lot. From the middle of February through June 22nd, I was going to be home for one day on May 5th. It turns out I was home all of the days. We did film the Mozart episode of Now Hear This in San Luis Obispo. And we did that in the beginning of March and then in the beginning of July. So the entire episode was filmed during COVID. And it was kind of a bizarre experience to film, well, to do anything during COVID, but especially film. I mean, the director of photography was constantly using a long lens, something that they would shoot, let's say a bird with, to shoot me and whoever else was on screen with me, because they wanted to compress the image and make it seem like everybody was like super close together when we weren't. We were actually 9 feet apart. One of the hard parts of shooting that episode was simply we couldn't hear each other because we were so far apart. And we're having this kind of intimate conversation, but we're really far apart from each other. The first scene of this episode, of the San Luis Obispo episode, it's called Becoming Mozart. It takes place in front of an orchestra. We're all in the pack. And everybody was on risers so that the camera people could shoot up at people so that to sort of disorient the viewer. Everybody was at least 8 feet apart from each other, because we didn't want anybody to get sick. But if you have an orchestra that's everybody's 8 feet apart, it looks like if I try to grow a mustache, there's just not enough hairs on my face to make a believable mustache. It doesn't look like an orchestra because there are not enough people on stage. So what they did was they staggered everybody just a little bit so that it looks like they're right next to each other, but actually they're very far apart from each other. And then with that long lens, it glues everybody together and makes everybody look like they're right next to each other. They had all kinds of diagrams to make sure that everybody looked super close to each other. It's fascinating. I don't know anything about it, but it's cool. So what was really super bizarre, usually when you shoot Now Hear This, they say, okay, camera's ready, rolling, action. And then you just do your scene. With this one, there was an added step, which was cameras rolling, camera one, take position 32, camera two, take position 23, camera three, take position 17. Violins, take your masks off. Everybody else, leave your mask on. Rolling. So there were these two extra steps of the camera people couldn't improvise where they were standing. They usually improvise that. They couldn't, because if they're improvising, then suddenly people are going to be seem like they're really far apart. So when the violinists had their masks off, the cellists all had their masks on. And so it was this really strange. And then when they said cut, then the director would always yell, everybody masks on. A lot of TV is just waiting. So a lot of what we were just doing was just had our masks on, just waiting. So, you know, it was good. Not one person got sick and nobody's families got sick. We were good to be prudent.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. You're listening to a conversation between Scott Yu, music director of Festival Mosaic and host of the PBS series Now Hear This, and the Slow Chamber of Commerce's Jim D'Antona.
What was it that, in terms of featuring Slow and Festival Mosaic and Now Hear This, we're closing out this season with it, what made you feel that passion to do it this way?
The filmmaker wanted to do a episode on teaching somebody how to conduct. And so we needed an orchestra. And he asked me, can we do this in Mexico City? And I said, I don't know. I'm not sure. I actually said, let me talk to one of my friends. And so our second clarinetist, Michael Fine, he and I talked about which London orchestra could we do this with, or could we do it in Paris or here or there? And then he said, well, Scott, I mean, you already conduct one of the greatest orchestras in the world, the Festival Mosaic Orchestra. It's better than all the orchestras we've been talking about. Why don't you just do it in slow? So I brought it back to Harry, our filmmaker, and I said, hey, why don't we do it in slow? And he said, you know, that's actually a nice idea. Plus, the festival used to be called the Mozart Festival, so there's a nice tie-in there. And then when he came to San Luis Obispo, he used to take hikes, and I think he was really impressed by how beautiful San Luis Obispo is. And then he said to me, well, we haven't really got much natural beauty in this TV series, and we've gotten plenty of churches, concert halls, what have you. So he said, I think San Luis Obispo is perfect. I said, okay, great. So San Luis Obispo and where else? Because we always shoot in two or three different countries for each episode. And he said, no, San Luis Obispo is going to be enough. There's enough there. There's so much wealth there of visual things that we're going to do it in San Luis Obispo. And I thought, great. That's fantastic for Festival Mosaic. It's fantastic for the town. I mean, I know that we've had Sideways, but that was already a while ago, right? That was 17 years ago. We got some love from Oprah. But, you know, this is something that's not about wine. It's cultural, but it's all about San Luis Obispo. The entire PBS hour, 53 minutes, it's all about San Luis Obispo. It's about Mozart. It's about the festival. It's really a great way to showcase how great it is in slow. People that I've shown the episode to, they gasped when they saw Cambria. And they said, wow, where is that? I said, oh, that's just Cambria. Or when they see Sarah Chapel, Chapel Sarah up in Shannon, they say, where is that? That looks otherworldly. I said, it's awesome there. It's incredible. I mean, think about it. They have the PAC, which is world-class concert hall. They've got a very famous film festival. And then we got this music festival that's artistically one of the 10 strongest in the country. My friend Michael insists that it's one of the two or three best orchestras in the world right now. I mean, it's just because it's an all-star group. I mean, it's an artificial situation. We have no weaknesses. Everybody is an incredible player.
This is the last episode of season 2. Is there more coming?
Well, we are starting season 3. I can't say that officially because my boss, PBS, they're very private about that sort of thing. But between us, we are in pre-production for season 3, which we are going to be shooting this fall. With COVID precautions, we are going to all be on a bus. We're going to shoot in the United States. We will shoot American composers, Aaron Copland, Amy Beach, Florence Price, other composers. We will have a doctor with the production team. That person's job will be to administer a rapid response COVID test to every member of the crew and me and the director and any guest. We will be tested every single day. We're going to have redundancies for everyone except for me and the director, so that if any one person gets sick, we'll make a very rapid change, and we'll probably be on the road for 40 days and try to shoot 4 episodes in 40 days, just back to back to back to back to back, no rest. So it's going to be pretty grueling, but America wants to see something new. We don't want to just watch reruns for another year.
I like to think of the artists who have been wanting to play but have not been able to. I mean, have they been excited to get out and do some of these things?
1 out of 10 people that we asked to do the Mozart episode in San Luis Obispo said no. They said, I don't feel comfortable traveling. And we totally respect that, 100%. 9 in 10 people said, get me there. I'm so hungry to do this. So what we expect preparing season 3 is that if we ask 20 musicians to be on the show, 4 of them are going to say no. And 16 of them are going to say yes. And so we'll have to ask 25 people to get 20. We understand that. And we totally respect those who are, you know, there's some of my friends who are extra, extra careful. Totally respect that. That makes complete sense. We were very, very careful. I mean, we were wearing masks all the time, including outside. We just never took the mask off, just to be sure.
Are you getting out and everybody hanging out at a park and just doing a little playing, or is there anything happening like that?
So at Festival Mosaic, we did a couple of concerts in July that were in front of, I think, 15 people at a time, 20 people at a time. Everybody was more than 10 feet apart, socially distanced. So that kind of quenched that thirst a little bit. I think, Jim, to be very frank, I think I was approaching the point of just total burnout, just given the number of concerts I was doing from January to June. I remember telling my wife, I'm not sure how I'm going to survive this spring, because it just was so much one after another. And I just said, I'm not sure how I'm going to survive this. And the pandemic has definitely affected different people differently. I'm one of the very fortunate ones because I continued working for the TV show and I kind of had a role in society. Some of my other friends, you know, have largely been grounded and haven't been able to do much. I've had friends who've lost most of their income and really needed government assistance. So I consider myself to be one of the extremely fortunate people, the fortunate among the fortunate. I'm grateful for that.
Sure. The Slow episode, and if people want to catch Now Hear This, it's on PBS, correct?
You can watch it on pbs.org. They stream it for about a month, and then they put it up behind the paywall, and that's called the PBS Passport. It's PBS's version of Netflix, and actually it's actually not very expensive. I subscribe to it because it's $60 a year. It's like $5 a month. You can also watch it if you have an Amazon Prime account. They do release Now Hear This on Amazon Prime. Other than that, it did appear on YouTube for a little while. Season one had over 1 million views on YouTube. It was up for a few weeks, and then PBS found it, and of course, you know, and knocked it right off, because that's kind of verboten.
Any kind of future here, looking at, you know, Festival Mosaic coming around? Are you guys putting the plans together for what this next season will look like?
Absolutely. So I think we're pretty much done planning next summer, hoping that happens. But we have various menu options. We can do this option, and if they don't allow us to do that, we'll do this option or this or this. And then we have a bunch of concerts that we're looking forward to presenting to San Luis Obispo. I'll be there and some of the other festival favorite performers. We have, I think, 4 or 5 different concerts that are planned, and it's just a matter of us getting the green light to do them in a safe and responsible way.
We really, truly appreciate you taking the time today and being with us from your home in Missouri there.
I'm grateful to you. Thank you, Jim.
Pleasure.
That was Scott Yu, music director of Festival Mosaic and host of a 4-part documentary series on PBS's Now Hear This. He was speaking with Jim D'Antona of the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce. Next up on this week's nonprofit story, the San Luis Obispo Legal Assistance Foundation.
Welcome. This is Dr. Consuelo Mutz with the Nonprofit Story. Today I have with us Donna Jones. She is the executive director of the San Luis Obispo Legal Assistance Foundation. And according to the website, the mission of the SLO Legal Assistance Foundation is to provide legal services and resources to people in need. Let's get into it and find out what San Luis Obispo Legal Assistance Foundation is all about. Hi, Donna, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Consuelo. It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me on.
I'm excited to have you because having known SLO Law, as we call it in the community, for so many years now, I know that you do so much more than many people in the community know about. So would you just really tell us your whole mission and what do you do in our community?
We started, believe it or not, in 1992, and some attorneys in town realized that there were a lot of SLO County residents who could not afford traditional legal services. They just didn't have the income for that. And so they weren't getting any legal services, or very few. I mean, there just wasn't a lot here in town. And so they started SLO Laugh to be able to help provide those. It was all done originally through volunteer attorneys. Mm-hmm. And then over the years, as we've been able to get some grant funding, we have brought on different employees. We started with, like I said, attorneys, and now we're at 4 full-time employees. So we've really grown a lot over the years. And had a lot of different, I guess you would say, areas that we covered. You know, at one point, we were involved in mediation, some different elder abuse things. Really took hold in 1996 when we got a grant from the Area Agency on Aging and started doing the Senior Legal Services Project. That was our flagship project, and we did that for years. We still do it. offering a variety of services to seniors in our area. That would be anybody 60 or above. We were doing everything from what we call planning for incapacity, which is preparing documents like a durable power of attorney for finances or an advanced healthcare directive or a simple will, maybe doing some government benefits if something's wrong with your Social Security and you feel that you should be getting something different, helping you work through that, because that's a pretty daunting system there to get through on your own. Consumer finance, and then we did a ton of housing work for our seniors. And then we also took on a few years ago a partnership with CapSlow, where we're working with their Supportive Services for Veteran Families program and helping veterans who are homeless or in imminent risk of becoming homeless with whatever the legal needs are, you know, to get them permanently housed. And that was what we did for a while. And recently, the housing issues have just blown up, as you can imagine, especially with COVID, the emergency eviction moratorium that kind of kept things at bay for a little while, but that was lifted at the beginning of September, about a month ago. And there are some new legislative things in place now, but it definitely narrowed the scope of who was able to be evicted. And they have some things that they have to sign off on as far as it being COVID related.
Just to clarify though, you are a 501c3 nonprofit, correct?
We absolutely are, yes. Well, most of it comes from grants, but we do need donations for, you know, our general operating support. We do a big fundraiser every year to bring in the funds for that. We're very fortunate that we have some grants that come in that are very program related. You know, they fund specific things, but it's what enables us to be able to go out there and offer these programs to the public.
You are pretty unique because of your focus area. And do you think people really know what you're doing, or have they been able to find you and connect?
I think we're one of the best kept secrets in San Luis Obispo County. One of the things that definitely opened up the public's eyes to us was all of the press that we got with about the last year and a half or so with the Grandview Apartments case, with 50 plus units, hundreds of people had a major habitability issues with their apartment, and we were handling that. It's been a long, long, long process. It's still going 2 years later. But it definitely put us on the map more with the general public because there's been a lot of press around it because they're concerned about it. Housing in this area is definitely an issue on a multitude of fronts.
You are getting even more involved in housing, and that is huge right now, especially with COVID. Tell us a little bit more about that.
I wish that I could give you some details on a couple of new programs that are coming up, but we don't have our contracts yet. We are waiting for them, but there's some exciting news coming up very soon. We'll definitely be doing a press release on it, and you'll see it with some different programs that we're going to be able to offer to expand our housing services. We have been doing work for mostly seniors and veterans around landlord-tenant things, accessibility, habitability, just different things. And we also offer foreclosure prevention legal services for seniors. Because of these new grants that we've gotten, we will be able to start serving a lot more of this low county population. And that's one of the things we're excited about, is that it won't be as age restricted. It is income restricted. The programs vary as far as what the income levels are that you know, we can serve people that are under particular income levels. So I won't get into all the details of that here, because there are several different programs. And you do have to be low income in order to be able to get our services. We know that there's plenty of those people in our county. We're really excited that we're going to get the chance to be able to help them, because that's what they need. It's anything legal isn't easy. And you really do need professionals who know what they're doing on that. And it's just been so inaccessible to so many people that we're really happy that we can help with that. So I encourage anyone who has any kind of a housing issue, if you think we might be able to help you, to certainly reach out, because if we are not able to serve you under our specific programs, we will, you know, we have a ton of resources that we can refer you to. There is another agency in town, CRLA, California Rural Legal Assistance, that handles different cases than we do, and they're similar. So hopefully we can find someone that can help anybody that's having an issue around here. So yeah, just call us or email us and we will let you know, and we'll ask some questions to establish whether you're eligible for our programs or not. And if not, then we'll have some resources for you.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. KCBX contributor Consuelo Mukes is speaking with Donna Jones of the San Luis Obispo Legal Assistance Foundation.
So you mentioned earlier that you have four staff. How are you actually able to get the services?
So the four employees are me as the executive director, and I am not an attorney. I'm a CPA, and I handle pretty much everything for the organization outside of the delivery of the legal services. Stephanie Barclay is our legal director, and she oversees the entire legal program. And then we have a staff attorney, Sadie Weller, and lots of volunteer attorneys. And that's one of the neat things that we have is that we are able to leverage attorneys who are, some of them are in practice, some of them are retired, but they've said, I really want to give back to the community, and this is a great way that I can do it if I only have a couple of hours a week or something like that. So that's our legal team right at this moment. And then we also have an office administrator who provides just all of the admin help that you can imagine that a legal program needs.
Do you happen to have services that are bilingual?
We do. Our office administrator, Annette, is bilingual in English and Spanish, and that has just been a fantastic addition for us. Besides the fact that she's just a lovely human, she is bilingual, and that has really helped us, like, for example, with the Grandview case, because so many of the residents up there were Spanish speakers.
So do you have any examples of maybe some of the ways that you've been able to help people? I know you're talking about the housing issue, but you've also helped with other senior issues.
Oh gosh, there's so many. And each story is so unique. I've seen everything from a senior that ended up in a contract for a vacuum cleaner that was thousands of dollars, that of course makes absolutely no sense, and felt that something had gone awry there, and we were able to help her negotiate out of that. We've had elder abuse situations where even APS, Adult Protective Services, contacts us and says, we think that there's something going wrong here and you need to help look into this because we think we may have maybe financial elder abuse going on or something like that. Sometimes seniors don't feel safe in their own home because someone who has come to stay with them needs to leave so that they can feel safe in their own home again. You name it, it's out there. Grandview, I think, was a great example of a case where they were living in bed bugs and molds and broken electricity and windows, and the landlord wasn't doing anything about it. And so we were representing the tenants in trying to get the houses fixed, the apartments in that case, and the owners decided that it was better for them to just shut down instead of doing the repairs. And so all of those residents had to find another place to live. And that was challenging. And we did help some of them to be able to stay as long as possible until they found other housing. So it really runs the gamut. We've had situations where someone feels that what they're getting from the Social Security Administration isn't right. They're being denied a government benefit that they feel is something that's due to them. And we have a volunteer attorney who's fantastic at navigating that system who can go in and say, no, I think you're right. Or if not, explain to them why it is that they're being given the information that they're being given. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of all over the place. Evictions, what's happening right now, that's the requirements are quite stringent and not very easy to understand. And so we see a lot of evictions come through that are not actually proper according to the law. And so we're able to say, okay, this is not a proper eviction. You may end up getting evicted eventually and it may be okay, but right now, this is not the proper paperwork. And so we're able to buy some time until things get straightened out.
You know, it sounds like it doesn't have to be this person specifically to contact you, but then an advocate can contact you also. Is that correct?
To a certain degree. I mean, we would need to speak with the client themselves because it is like as in a traditional legal setting where there's an attorney-client relationship and the privilege there. And so if someone wanted to say, I feel like something bad is going on with my neighbor, we would need for the neighbor to call us and say, but you know, a lot of times that's just setting up the relationship to say, hey, we are here and yes, we can help you with that. Give them our number and have them call.
As a 501c3, and you still do need support from the community. How can the community help San Luis Obispo Legal Aid Assistance Foundation?
Right now, just financial donations would be fantastic. And we were one of the many nonprofits that was not able to do our large fundraiser this year. That was a large chunk of our operating budget. So we are now basically surviving with donations. Every once in a while, we'll get a client donation, but really they're low income and they're the ones that can't afford to pay for the services, which is why they're with us in the first place. And so donations from the public are always welcome. You can either mail us a check or you could go on our website and just hit the donate button and send some love our way.
Ending up being an essential service during this time.
It is, you know, it's one of those weird words that what's essential and what's not. It really is. When people are having issues, and a lot of times they just need someone to talk to say this, help explain what is the situation that they are in. We get calls even for areas of the law that we don't serve, and the people just really need someone to help them navigate what is the situation that I am in right now, because I think so many people have just gotten thrown into situations that they never would have expected a year ago. They need help.
Right. So what in particular will you not be able to do? Like, what are some examples of law areas that you won't serve?
So we don't do criminal work. That would need to be referred to public defenders. We, at the moment, we are not doing family law. We don't have any attorneys on staff or a program for that. So we're really working more with housing and with the seniors, with consumer law for the seniors and government benefits. There will be some more things added shortly. And like I said, I can't go into those right now, but you will be seeing a few more things shortly. If you want to sign up for our newsletter, we would be thrilled to add you to our mailing list. There is a way to do that on the website. We'll be able to keep you up to date on everything. www.slo for San Luis Obispo, LAF, Legal Assistance Foundation.org.
Well, Donna, thank you so much for joining us, talking with the Executive Director of the San Luis Obispo Legal Assistance Foundation, Donna Jones, and thank you for joining us on The Nonprofit Story.
On this month's edition of Playing with Food, Father Ian Dellinger joins a quest for local wild yeast used to make beer.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food.
We're going to head out to Mission Canyon, right by the Santa Barbara Arboretum or Botanical Gardens.
Yeast, it's all around us. During the pandemic, home bakers were having trouble finding yeast in the stores. One of the perks of living on the Central Coast is that we have unfettered access to unprocessed fresh produce, so why not use fresh, unprocessed yeast? It's easy. You just put a jar of flour, water, and sugar outside with cheesecloth over the top, and voila, you've captured some yeast.
We're going to set up 4 sites for yeast propagation. This is to capture wild yeast that is local and native to the Santa Barbara foothills. We'll hopefully make some delicious beer with it.
2 popular uses of yeast are for beer making and bread making. Playing with Food went on a hunt for local wild yeast and has produced a segment on each of those uses. A 5-month, 1,800-mile journey with my new, now good buddy, Chip Nasser from Night Lizard Brewing Company in Santa Barbara. This one is about capturing and propagating wild yeast, specifically wild yeast captured near Poison Oak, to make beer. And here's how we did it.
We're doing it right now just because it's the fall harvest season and a lot of fruits and berries and wild plants are all flowering and producing their fruit or have produced all of their fruit, and the fruit will remain on the trees and now be starting to rot. And that's actually advantageous for the yeast because it tends to form in the skins or any protective layers of the fruit. Once those skins rupture during the rotting process, they tend to expand and produce gases and stuff like that. That actually allows the yeast to then enter the fruit and start to ferment the fruit on the vine. And it also brings insects and allows them to, especially bees, to collect yeast on their bodies and transport it through the environment. So today we're going to primarily be going after manzanita berries that are still on the vine. Hopefully we'll be able to find some good clumps of them still on there. There's a pretty big grove we're headed up to.
So is that all the equipment rattling in the back?
It is, yeah. Those are our mason jars that are filled up with wort, which is a sugary malt liquid. So what we try to do is emulate something that would be like the sugar juices that would be coming out of a rotten piece of fruit right now. So this is our little kit for yeast sampling. Nothing really, really fancy. We got 4 glass jars filled with wort. They're each numbered and covered with cheesecloth over the top. The cheesecloth is affixed to the top of the jar with a rubber band, and then the metal lid is sealed on top of the cheesecloth and the rubber band. That's our sanitized layer right there at the end of the sampling. We'll leave the jars out there with just the cheesecloth on. All of the lids will come off, and that helps to mitigate any sort of like debris, wood, or anything falling into the jars. Bees are like one of the number one transporters of yeast because they have like such fuzzy bodies. They are great receptor sites for yeast to stick to them. And because we have a sugary broth liquid jars right here, bees actually like it. So they'll come in, check it out, walk across the top of the cheesecloth, and hopefully some yeast will fall inside. And it's about a half a mile hike in, and it's all uphill.
We are here
at Mission Creek. I'm just gonna hop down here and do the base of that oak tree right by that rock for my first sample. And now I've wedged it in between a rock and a coastal live oak tree.
A rock and a hard spot.
Yeah. There is like a little bit of like mixed foliage around it, like brush, that I'm hoping will attract a little bit of insect activity, and then tons of poison oak kind of scattering the whole backside. I'm like surrounded by poison oak.
Sorry about
that. No.
Oh, I'm right next to it as well.
Yeah.
What kind of yeast does poison oak give you?
We've never sampled the poison oak areas. This will be the most poison oak areas we've ever sampled.
Right next to your right elbow.
Yeah, poison oak here and poison oak there. Well, this will be the poison oak sample. That's it. That's the entire putting out of the sample process. You know, it doesn't take long at all. It's something that you can whip together in like 45 minutes. So if people wanted to collect their own yeast, there's no reason to be scared of it or anything like that. We're hiking out. Yeah, luckily it's all downhill on the way out.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Father Ian on a hunt for wild yeast with Chip Nasser of Night Lizard Brewing Company. Meanwhile, back at the brewery.
What you're going to do with it now?
Wait for 24 hours right now until tomorrow morning. I'll hike back out there, and then I'll allow those jars to ferment for the next 5 to 7 days. I'll also look to see if there's any weird stuff in there, like mushrooms, fungus, bacteria, mold. Anything like that would be an indicator that it's not a viable sample. At the end of those 7 days, I'll open up all the lids, smell them first. If it smells a little bit like beer, that's the number one indicator that you have something that's good. If it smells foul, sour, you could have viable yeast, but not yeast that we would want to make beer out of.
What's success rate?
Usually it's around 5% success rate of catching a viable yeast strain that you could use. If one of those jars gets something, it's pretty lucky out of the 4 that we did.
A week later.
So these are what happened to our samples after a week, but I left them for you to smell. Not a great or pleasant experience. The smells range from like wet, hot garbage to old cabbage.
Should we start with the worst first?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. It smells like the trash bags outside of a pub from the night before.
Yep.
So it's like wet, hot trash with beer.
With a little beer?
Yeah.
That's a great description, yeah. And this one, actually, you can see bacterial cultures in the jar. So that's
mold.
Indicator. Ooh. And that one's got quite a bit of carb to it.
Yeah. It smells like when you go into a bar the next morning and the floor's all sticky, and it smells like just old beer.
And it probably could be Sabretomyces yeast, like the wild kind of see it. It's like spider yeast.
Okay, and this is number 3. This was the bay tree.
Yep, and you can even see a little slime mold on that one.
It's kind of gross.
Yeah.
That just smells icky. It doesn't smell like anything but ick. So that was an experience. So those 3 are not going to be used at all.
They're not. Yeah, I'm actually going to get them out of the lab right now. Number 2 is not a pure yeast culture in the sense that I don't believe that there is just beer yeast that we're looking for.
There's poison oak as well.
There could be poison oak, yeah. The irony that it's got the best yeast. There also could be a couple of other organisms in here right now at the moment. So we'd say it's like a mixed culture. It's got like a sweet smell almost to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a little nutty. We're going to set up a plating, inoculate a couple of petri dishes with our sample, and then throw them in the incubator for about 24 to 48 hours.
A week later.
Take a look inside the microscope, and then you'll see some very, very small dots. They almost look like specks of dust.
I thought they were dust on the lens.
So those are small yeast cultures right there that are just trying to keep themselves alive as the Brettanomyces yeast is kind of spreading across the whole plate. So I'm going to scoop out those little guys and then inoculate them into this 2 liters of wort that I have. There's nothing in here other than malt, sugar, and water. We're gonna let that sit for about 5 days. And then if everything goes well with that next round, it'll be a 3 liter. That'll actually get pitched into a 31 gallon batch of beer, our end goal. The yeast flocks out, meaning it gets heavy enough, sticks together, falls to the bottom of the flask, and all of this white powder right here is all of the yeast. And I'll decant all of the liquid off of the top, so I just have this powdery slurry left at the bottom before I pitch it in.
The yeast is on its way to being beer now.
Yeah, I'd say it's way more than halfway now. The plating, I'd say, is about the halfway point. In 10 days' time, make a beer with that yeast if everything turns out.
And Chip has captured yeast before.
That was our previous yeast culture, our yeast strain that we sent to Imperial Organics, and they ran the whole strain through PCR tests and DNA analysis. They found that we have like a novel strain that we captured out here in the Santa Barbara Hills. So
that's great.
They grew it up for us, propagated it, and now we're going to buy a pitch from them that has been all cleaned in the lab and everything like that. I mean, I'm doing kind of, you know, backwoods bootleg biology here. I'm sanitary and stuff like that, and I have the laboratory or the good manufacturing processes from my time at biotech, but I don't have nearly the labs that they have up there. So just kind of taking it to the next level. Once we knew we had something that was good and made a good beer, we wanted to make it even better.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio, and you're listening to Playing with Food on Issues and Ideas. I'm Father Ian, and I'm with Chip Nasser of Night Lizard Brewing Company, making beer with wild yeast. When it was time to make the beer, I headed back to Santa Barbara.
Today we're going to taste a little bit of the beer that's been fermented out from the wild yeast we captured out in Mission Creek from the poison oak bush. It's going to be a pretty bland beer. It doesn't have really any hops or any strong malt character, and that's done deliberately so we get the flavor of the yeast really forward. The first example of what a beer could taste like from our wild yeast.
It is bland, but it's still got flavor.
Yeah, I get like a fruity raisin note to it.
Taste that raisin.
Yeah, like a dates and raisin type. It's definitely more Belgian character.
It tastes like if you poured yourself a glass of beer and then woke up in the morning and needed to go to work, came home and cleaned up 48 hours later from watching football or whatever.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, I'm going to taste this beer that's
sitting there. Yeah.
Well, completely flat.
It's just been right out of the Erlenmeyer flask with the yeast and then right into our mouths. Just from the flavor of the liquid itself, it does have a lot of like fruitiness, Belgian character to me, like just a little bit of funkiness. And I think that's just because of the wild character of the yeast.
That was your test beer. You're going to show me how to make beer with wild yeast?
Yeah.
The wild yeast that we caught?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, where do we start?
Right now, we're going to start with milling the grain. Right now, we're heating up some water to put that grain into, and we'll start our sugar extraction process in there. Start mashing. Yeah, so it'll be about 3 hours from right now, so we'll do the hour rest that Clay was mentioning right there. We'll run off all of that liquid, taking all of the sugary liquid out, and then we'll boil it for 90 minutes.
Always a nice smell too, if you want to get up there and get a little good whiff of it. It'll smell more malty now, and then in an hour, it'll actually be more sweet. So.
It all like the kitchen last night? Or?
Smells like the kitchen last night, yeah.
So now we're gonna let this sit for an hour, let all the enzymes get cranking in there. So right now we're running off the sugary wort. At the same time, I'm heating up this kettle to start boiling. That's where we'll boil for the next step, the 90 minute boil. And then after that is when we'll pitch our yeast.
Okay.
We're on our way to beer.
So this is our yeast that we found on Poison Oak.
Poison Oak inside of Mission Creek.
How many weeks ago?
6 weeks now.
It's been 6 weeks and it's finally fulfilling its destiny.
As beer,
Hopefully,
yeah.
It's still not 100%, right?
Yeah, we got a 10-day window before we know for sure, but it's looking good.
Okay.
It's looking good.
Have you ever put the yeast in the wort and waited 10 days for it to ferment and nothing happened?
Yeah, definitely we have. I wouldn't say it's a regular occurrence by any means. Beer that's not attenuated, that hasn't made its alcohol, is kind of the bane of brewer's existence. It's the worst thing that you can have happen.
The beer was successful. It was time to taste.
So what are you going to call it?
Right now we have a 2X Native Wild Ale. It's probably going to change. That's currently, and the reason it's 2X is because of the booze. It's a boozier version of it. So it's probably going to be something like a Santa Barbara Wild Wheat Ale.
I really think you should name it Poison Oak something.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, Poison Oak Ale. I'm worried about people, I'm extremely allergic to Poison Oak. Is there, any Poison Oak that made it? It's weird how just one word can really make people not want to drink something.
Poison is probably not good in a title, right.
Poison in a beer.
Even though they say name your poison.
That's true.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, pick your poison.
Cheers. Listen,
I've never tried it before.
You haven't tried this? No. Are you sure you haven't tried it?
Haven't tried it.
What if it's horrible?
Could be horrible.
How do you know whether it's bad or not?
The smell usually can tell me that there's no contamination or anything like that, so we're at least safe to drink it.
Okay.
Yeah
down
cheers.
The hatch.
Yeah. It's good. Yeah, very Belgian-y in flavor, and that's all the yeast. It's a very basic grain recipe. Not too many hops in there. Can't really taste the alcohol either. It's got about 8%.
It's tasty. It's very creamy.
It is, yeah.
What do you think makes it creamy?
We did just carbonate it yesterday, so it could be that it's just a little bit whipped up from that whole process.
Okay.
It does have that velvety mouthfeel. That could also be the amount of wheat that we used. I don't know if you remember, we used a lot of wheat in there, and that tends to give you that velvety smoothness to it. Also, it's white. Hazy. I think it's going to approach a big group, or I hope it is, that it's a native Santa Barbara yeast, that it's right in their backyard, and nobody else has this yeast in the world. We know we got it out of a poison oak bush. Nobody else has got this. I think anybody that likes Belgian beers all the way to somebody that wants to try something new from their backyard would be interested in it.
How much does the yeast contribute to the flavor?
So yeast is the number one, in my opinion, impact on both the hop flavor and the malt flavor. The yeast is doing all kinds of crazy chemical reactions inside its body while it's converting the sugar into alcohol. Additionally, that's unique about our brewery, that we use a different yeast strain for every single beer that we make in here. All 16 beers have different yeasts, which is unique. A lot of breweries will do one yeast for every single beer they make. I've never tasted a yeast quite like this. It's got like a little bit of a sweetness on the back end. Most Belgian strains are a lot more dry finishing. For being 8% alcohol, I'm surprised that it still has that a little bit of sweet finish to it. That might just be the yeast that did that.
Based on what you've tasted now, would you use this yeast again?
Yeah, we're planning on it. Hopefully this guy's gonna grow up. This is the last that we have in house of the poison oak. We did send a little bit up north too to just see if we got another unique strain.
Chip gave me a crowler of the poison oak beer with an ABV of 10%. Having hung on to it well into the shelter at home period, I knew that I couldn't drink that much at that ABV by myself. So I drank some while I made beer-battered fish and chips, beer-battered fried chicken, and a couple of other things. The highly flavored beer was excellent in the glass and on the plate. This was a very unique journey with great results. Using wild yeast from a poison oak bush to make beer is something that never, ever popped into my mind before meeting Chip. He does an amazing job at playing with food, and he's quite good at it.
About a 10% chance to get a viable yeast strain, and we've done it twice now getting viable strains, so we have good luck.
And the second time was the poison oak
time.
So I was there.
You were there.
Oh wow.
Yeah okay. you're there for it for sure. Catching yeast is one thing, but having a yeast that actually produces the flavors that you would like to have in a beer, that's a whole nother animal right there. So we're super lucky that the yeast strains that we've had do produce those fruity esters that are true to Belgian style.
And like with the first yeast strain, he's sent it off to be tested, cleaned, and ready for commercial use, but...
I kept some of the original yeast culture that we have. I have it banked in our fridge, so I could prop that back up and get exactly the same, get it going. That's the way I'd prefer to go, just because the couple of pitches that we've got back from them are so good because they've cleaned them up and there's not any weirdness in there anymore. It almost tastes too clean. It tastes like a commercial strain again. And that, the unique flavors you get for it is that character, that Santa Barbara yeast character that nobody else has, because nobody else has harvested yeast from poison oak bush in the tunnel trail of Santa Barbara. So yeah, it's definitely something that's unique to the Central Coast, that's for sure.
We went on a hunt for wild yeast to make beer and to make bread. And that is how we did it. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. It's at kcbx.org.